Our next speaker is Maya Evans, and as I said before, she's from the Stop the War National Office. But also to say a bit about her, Maya Evans is a campaigner with Voices for Creative Nonviolence UK, which is a solidarity peace group who work with youth peace activists in Afghanistan. She's traveled to Kabul 10 times over the last 10 years, learning about the situation on the ground for ordinary Afghans. She also fundraises as well as develops and promotes awareness campaigns. Last year, she published a short pamphlet, Afghanistan: Hidden Voices from the Forgotten War, which is a snapshot of the current political situation, as well as stories from Afghanistan and opinions of the Afghan youth. So it's, as Alex said, it's really important for us to, on the eve of this 20th anniversary, that we discuss Afghanistan. So a big thanks to her coming along tonight from south of the country. I think deep south, aren't you, the country to address tonight. And if you want to put up share on the screen, just
I'll hit share when I get to that moment.
Yeah.
So thank you so much, both Roger and Alex, and thank you, Alex, for that summary and the recap of the last 20 years. And that really took me back to, in 2001, I was actually living in Liverpool and I was a student. I remember very clearly 9/11, and I joined the Stop the War group there. And very much we were doing a similar thing in Liverpool as you were doing in Newcastle. And we were sort of close enough to be going down to the demos as well, sort of every month that they were happening in London, organized by Stop the War. And then, yeah, remembering that history is very sort of personal to me, because I remained being a campaigner throughout that time. And you mentioned about the naming the dead. I did a protest in 2005 where we were reading the names of the dead opposite the cenotaph. And I was arrested for reading the names of British soldiers and Iraqis who were killed. And then became the first person prosecuted under the Serious Organized Crime and Police Act. So that's the legislation that you were talking about, which was criminalizing activists as well as black and brown people. And so that was quite a big media thing at the time. And that sort of led on to me heading a high court case around the complicity of British soldiers in the torture of Afghan detainees. And that was in the High Court in 2010, and with some, you know, fancy lawyers that you get on legal aid. And the High Court judges at the end of the trial said that recommended that the British government changes their policy in Afghanistan in regards to how British soldiers were capturing Afghans in the theatre of war, handing them over to the Afghan secret police, who were then torturing them. And so then that sort of led me on. We did a protest outside Northwood, and John McDonnell was there, actually, very briefly. He kind of did a little speech, and we all went off to Northwood, and we did some direct action there, which led to an arrest and then a sort of short spell in prison. And that was about a helicopter bombing on an Afghan village where 47 civilians were killed at a wedding. And that was in, I think that was around sort of 2007, 2008, we did that. And that eventually led me on to becoming involved with Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And that was in 2011. And we started going out to Afghanistan. And as Roger described at the beginning, I started working in solidarity with a youth group out there called the Afghan Peace Volunteers. And they're sort of a mixture of protests along with sort of kind of aid projects and raising awareness and running campaigns as well. So that's my sort of personal history, I guess, just to sort of, I just thought I'd go, I don't normally go into that, but I thought as Alex was sort of reminiscing, I thought I would sort of relate my personal experience of some of the things that you were highlighting. So I will now start with my, is that right? Okay, let's see. From beginning, I guess. Okay, right. So Alex did a fantastic recap, and I thought I'd just do a very quick recap as well, through the chronicling the US presidents. So as we heard from the beginning, as we all know, as we were all there, in 2001, the 9/11 bombings, and we knew when we saw those images of the Twin Towers, I think most of us would be aware that we thought, well, this is the green light to the war on terror, to bombing Iraq, to direct access to oil fields. I think it was a sort of, everyone was sort of aware that, right, this is what the Americans have all been waiting for this time. So the kind of rhetoric that was being announced by Tony Blair and George Bush at the time was that, you know, it was a war on terror. We had to get these terrorists. We were under attack. And the three aims when they went into Afghanistan, which they promised at the time was going to be a lightning war. It was, they completely underestimated the Taliban. They perceived them as being, not very sophisticated, cave dwellers, AK-47s, terrorists. And they really thought, well, this is going to take a couple of months to steam in there. And their aims were to overthrow the Taliban. And they promised that they would not leave until the Taliban were defeated. Their second aim was to capture bin Laden. And then the third aim was to liberate Afghan women. So we might remember at the time, Sherry Blair and Nancy Bush, they were at the forefront of saying how they wanted to liberate the Afghan women. Sherry Blair had a meeting at Downing Street where she invited, human rights activists, leading feminists of the time, to talk about how they were going to support Afghan women. So that was a lot of the sort of propaganda and rhetoric that our politicians were using at the time. And so when they went into Afghanistan, it was a fairly sort of light touch war until about 2006, when the troops from Iraq were withdrawn and they were redeployed to Afghanistan. And then that was really a turning point in terms of the sort of the violence in the country. So that there was a massive ramping up from 2006. Barack Obama, when he came in 2009, he was more sort of, he pursued more of a sort of covert war, using a lot more drones. So he massively increased the use of drones in Afghanistan. He was the drone president. From a president's point of view, you have less US soldiers, boots on the ground, less danger to your forces. But obviously with drones, we know that they call it targeted killing, but in fact you racial profiling. So if you're, a group of young Afghan men and perhaps you're dressed as a Pashtun, who are the majority of the population in Afghanistan, and it's also the ethnic group which the Taliban belong to. And their sort of trademark look is the pakul hat. So, you have those kind of flat hats with the rim going around. If you're a young man between sort of 18 and 50, wearing the traditional Pashtun clothing in certain, Taliban areas, so maybe in the south, like Helmand or Kandahar, that would be enough. They'd use racial profiling the same way that police use racial profiling when they stop and search people in this country or in the US. Infamously in the US, if you're black, you're more likely to be stopped and searched or to be killed. In this country, as outlined by Alex at the beginning, there was a huge ramping up of legislation, domestic legislation targeted towards Muslims, stop and search being one of the main ones used. So that was sort of Barack Obama's line. He was quite cautious, but yeah, definitely wheeling out the drones. In 2011, so that's 10 years after the invasion, they finally caught bin Laden, who was actually in Pakistan. So that was 10 years of warfare in order to achieve that one of their three aims, which was capturing Osama bin Laden, who was in another country. So then we had Trump, 2017. And there's a lot more sort of publicity and people coming out now speaking about the legacy of Trump, because what it appears that he's doing is in the last few months of his reign, he is, as one of his officials in the White House said just last week to CNN, their goal is to set so many fires abroad that it will be hard for the Biden administration to put them out. So there's been a massive ramping up in the last couple of years by Trump, especially airstrikes. So there was a report that came out by the Cost of War, and they had calculated the number of airstrikes and calculated that in the last year, there's been a 95% increase in civilians killed. In 2018 alone, 3,800 Afghan civilians were killed in airstrikes. And there were 7,423 bombs that the US dropped in Afghanistan. So Trump has been, very divisive across the world, and in Afghanistan as well. Although we don't hear much publicity, we mainly hear that Trump wants to bring the troops home. It is likely that a lot of the troops will be withdrawn, but in the case, as elsewhere in the world, they'll probably be redeployed. So we heard last year that American troops were coming out of Syria, and they were redeployed elsewhere. We heard last week, well, a few months ago, that troops were coming out of Somalia, and then they were redeployed elsewhere in Africa. So yeah, so that's Trump's legacy, and not really sure what to expect in the next month. From Biden, we obviously know that he voted for the Iraq and Afghan war. He was very hawkish in the 90s and early 2000s. But then under Obama, he sort of mellowed a lot more. And I think we will sort of lightly expect to return to the status quo, which is a pretty low bar. But I think there's been a general acceptance within the establishment in the US that the imperial wars have been a disaster. There's been thousands of US soldiers killed. They've been unsuccessful in Afghanistan, 20-year war, the longest war in US history. Iraq has been a disaster. So there is this acknowledgement, I think, in the establishment in the US that these wars have been unsuccessful. And I imagine that Biden sort of route forward would probably be more, you know, status quo, so continuing arms sales and probably more covert wars through drone strikes as well. So what's been happening in Afghanistan? From February last year, there's been these peace talks that have been unfolding in Doha, Qatar, and that has been mainly with the Taliban and the Mujahideen. The Afghan government were not initially invited along. The Taliban have been very adamant that they don't accept the legitimacy of the Afghan government, who were obviously put into place when they were toppled in 2001. And the Afghan government, they are largely made up of warlords who were part of the civil war before the Taliban came in, between, you know, after the Russians came in 1979, there was 10 years of war with the Russians. And then there, before the Taliban, there was about 5 years of civil war where these local warlords in the different provinces around Afghanistan, they were sort of fighting each other. So a lot of the governors within the government at the moment are these ex-warlords who are responsible, who have blood on their hands. They're older men who have been trying to kill one another for decades. And here they are in Qatar, around a table, negotiating peace. So the person holding the ring is US Special Envoy Zalman Zaledad. And he was an Afghan-American diplomat, previously the US ambassador to the UN. And he was a former consultant for the RAND Corporation, and he was advising on the Trans-Afghan Pipeline. So it's quite interesting they've got him. He's obviously got a business mind. I thought I'd just plonk in this map here. I don't know, should I see if I can move our faces? So that's the provinces within Afghanistan. And you can see Afghanistan's a very strategic country. It's surrounded by it's landlocked around all these other countries. And if you see up in the right-hand corner, it actually borders China. Let's not forget that. So the Americans, I think, very unlikely to completely withdraw from Afghanistan. They've still got, I think it's 7 bases there. They'll probably draw down and keep a presence within those bases. And more importantly, there is a lot of natural raw materials still present in Afghanistan that the Americans no doubt have their eye on in terms of mining. And they will want to sort of compete with China. They won't want to allow China to move in and for their corporations to set up mining companies there. They will want to have the lion's share of that. And so it's precious materials, rare earth metals, lithium, which is really important for things like smartphones and devices, copper, uranium, gold, iron ore, cobalt, lead, zinc, some other things there listed. And then there's obviously the natural gas, and there's been a lot of conversations within Afghanistan about this pipeline that's supposed to be stretching from like sort of Turkmenistan across, supplying Pakistan and India. So that is definitely, you know, in the back of their minds as well when they're negotiating. So this booklet that I put together last year, it was kind of based on some vox pops that we did in Kabul the year, that year, with a load of teenagers from the project. And one of the comments, I thought, well, there's lots of different comments that I included in this booklet, but one of them I thought was particularly relevant. So I thought I'd just read it out. It's a young Afghan who's street kid, actually, 16 years old. And he said, "While the talks take place in Moscow, there is still fighting everywhere. They fight while they talk. There needs to be ceasefire while they negotiate. Usually there needs to be ceasefire even before negotiations begin. Up to now, the negotiations haven't involved young people. That's the tradition. It's the elders who meet. However, unfortunately, it's the elders who have been waging war. So I think the jirga will be about how to wage war. It will include members of the Mujahideen and the Taliban, and both are warmongers. Young people need to make their wishes known. If necessary, they should protest. Though this is dangerous, as in the past, there have been bomb attacks on such protests and people have been hurt. Young people have been disunited, especially along ethnic lines. Social media aren't being used well. 90% of news posted is fake, and the Facebook network in Afghanistan is corrupt." So there's a lot of interesting things there. 65% of the population in Afghanistan is now under the age of 25. So you've got a population, the majority have grown up it knowing nothing but war. But a lot of them have managed to gain an education. So that's one of the very few positives of the occupation, is that it did sort of facilitate young women, especially, to access education in cities like Kabul or Herat. So that was an opportunity that became available to young people, which wasn't previously available. So I personally feel that the hope is with the young people, but as Ifaz is his pseudonym, that's not actually his real name. We changed their names. I had to just check because I didn't want to. Now we have to change everyone's name because obviously we don't want to endanger them with the Taliban taking over. But as he also points out, there's been attacks throughout the peace talks. So I have a number of friends who have had their schools and their universities attacked. There's been attacks on hospitals. There was an attack on a maternity hospital. There's attacks on markets, the bazaars. So it's these like very kind of central, civil, very, you know, busy areas that the Taliban have been attacking throughout these peace talks. And there's also been, as I discussed earlier, a lot of airstrikes by the Trump administration throughout these talks. So for me, I'm not particularly convinced. So the red lines for the Americans, in order to sort of feel confident about withdrawal, is that they have to, the Taliban have to promise that they will never again harbor international terrorist organizations such as Al-Qaeda or IS. They have to do a power share if the Afghan government, which I think they're probably managed to wangle around that. And there has to be a ceasefire. So those are the sort of, those were the criteria. And the Taliban, they just basically want the Americans out. So it's been 2 years now. And I imagine the Taliban, they're pretty confident. They know they're not in any rush. They say that they've got, you know, hundreds of suicide bombers. They're playing the long game. They knew probably from 2001 that they if they just knuckled down, disappeared into the community, and held out, that they they, you know, they know the country well and they've got a lot of loyalty within the country, that they would, you know, they've, well, now they control about 70% of the country. So they've got, you know, without even controlling the government, so they definitely have the upper hand and they're definitely confident that they're going to win out in the end. So what is happening in Afghanistan for the people? And this is, you know, where the real tragedy is. Like with all wars, it's always the people who suffer the most. So this picture on the left-hand side is a scene very close to where I was staying in Kartasay. And this is actually a riverbed. So because of things like, because of climate change, there's been a massive dropping of the water table in Afghanistan. And water wells are having to be dug a lot deeper now. So this once luscious river, which people used to fish in for their dinner, is now home to some of the 3 million drug addicts that now occupy Afghanistan. So one of the things that isn't really talked about very much at the moment is opium production. And there's been something of a sort of revolution, if you like, in opium production in Afghanistan due to solar panels. So from 2012 to 2018, production of opium has increased, has doubled. So Afghanistan has always been the world leading producers of opium post-Taliban. It's now producing 90% of the world's opium. It's very high quality, cheap stuff. So within Afghanistan, there's 3 million people addicted. That's 10% of the population. And what's happening, for around $500, a farmer in somewhere in the desert sort of areas like Kandahar or Helmand, they can buy solar arrays and an electric pump, and they can dig wells three times the depth of normal wells and access water really deep down in the water table and irrigate the desert and produce these poppies. So that's what's happening at the moment. The obvious knock on is going to be a massive drought in water. So already there's a water issue within Afghanistan where only 27% of the population can access clean water. So with this extra demand on water and this just draining away from the deep reserves of the water table, in around 10 years time, that's going to be a huge crisis. And Britain has definitely a strong role in that. In 2001, when NATO and the US went in and they had the Bonn Conference, Britain was given the responsibility of handling the narcotics issue. So Britain was supposed to be managing this issue within Afghanistan, and Helmand, which is one of the main areas where the opium is produced today, was the province which Britain was stationed in. And there's been a lot of reports over the years whereby UK and US troops, military, have known about the production of opium and have even protected, in some cases, convoys because they've belonged to certain warlords who are in the government. So how is that? I wrote an article about this a few months ago that was published in Sussex Bylines, which is a sort of local publication where I live in Hastings. I kind of centered it more around the impact that had on British towns like Hastings. So we have been identified by Public Health England as being one of the coastal towns massively impacted by heroin. So heroin seems to impact sort of deprived coastal towns like Hastings the most, but there's been a huge surge in heroin addiction in this country. And it goes hand in hand with deprivation. So in the same way, you know, it's completely run away in Afghanistan and it's a massive issue because of the deprivation, because of suffering, that is also having an effect. It's coming home, like the war on terror has come home, opium is coming home as well. The other picture here is a refugee camp I photographed in Kabul a few years ago. And so when I first started doing talks about Afghanistan, it was 270,000 internally displaced. And I thought, oh, today when I was doing this talk, I thought, oh, just look up what's the latest, because I know it's always increasing. And I couldn't believe it. It's now 4.1 million who are internally displaced within Afghanistan. So since I've been doing these talks in the last 10 years, the number has just massively surged. So 1.1 million have been internally displaced because of natural disaster, and 3 million because of war and conflict. And then also Afghans are the second biggest refugee population within Europe as well, after Syria. They used to be the first biggest, but then, you know, after the Syrian war, they were overtaken. And it's very ironic, because I read an article a few months ago saying that the British drone, the Watchkeeper, which was a bit of a disaster, they paid Elbit, which is an Israeli company, arms company, to research and develop their drone, British drone arsenal, which they called the Watchkeeper. And they were sort of developing this in Wales and Abapur. And then they wheeled it out in Afghanistan at the end of 2014 to sort of, you know, field test, if you like. And it wasn't very effective. They bought it home, mothballed it, and now apparently recently they've dusted it off, and they're wheeling it out and flying it over the channel to identify refugees and migrants coming over. So I just thought, wow, that is phenomenal that, you know, in 2014, you could have had this British Watchkeeper flying over in Afghanistan. And if you were a young person who have fled, like thousands of Afghans have, because, you know, life is so desperate in the country, there's, you know, high unemployment, it's very dangerous, it's very depressing. You could be making your way across the channel, and then that very same drone is hovering over your head. So it's always important to remember that connection, and drones is something I've done a lot of work around, and there is a huge connection between, you know, the use of civil drones and military drones in terms of research, and then also this crossover of use as well. And I know for a fact that we're going to, in Hastings, the police are going to be piloting drones in our town centre for surveillance. So, and apparently, I think there's something like 40 local authorities have already, or police authorities across the country have already used surveillance drones in this country. So, you know, as I spoke about earlier, it uses a lot of racial profiling when they decide they're just drone strike. So obviously with surveillance in this country, there'll be a lot of profiling going on as well. So, I mean, I don't want to talk too much about the situation in Afghanistan, because sometimes when I kind of run through all the problems, I look out towards, like, you know, people in the audience, and their faces just look exhausted, because, you know, it is one of the most desperate countries in the world. The infrastructure is broken. The healthcare is non-existent. Unemployment is through the roof. You know, there's suicide bomb attacks every day in Kabul and across the country as well. It doesn't look like there's going to be peace anytime soon. There'll probably be some sort of civil war once all the US troops do withdraw. It's a really desperate situation, and I'm not confident that it's going to improve for Afghanistan. But if there are improvements, it will come from the younger generation. So the people, a lot of the people I've been working with, so this is the silver lining, this 85% of the population who are under 25. And these are some of the inspiring things that the group of young people I know, it's only one group that I know, I only pop over once a year, and they're doing incredible things. So that the first picture in the left-hand corner is a duvet project. And what they were doing is that they would buy raw materials from the bazaar. So that involved duvet covers and then this sort of synthetic wool. And they would pay local illiterate women to make duvets. And normally each woman would make 10 duvets a week, and they were paid for that. And then those duvets were piled high on a truck and then distributed to refugee camps or other poor communities. So that was like an income for local women, and then sort of like a aid for people most in need. And then the second picture down, that is a protest with the street kids school. So this youth group that I know, the Afghan Peace Volunteers, they also have a street kids school where they subsidize the kids to come off the streets once a week, and they subsidize them with a huge sack of rice and a tin of oil once a month. And they teach them basic literacy, numeracy, and peace studies. And this protest was one that the street kids, because they also do peace studies as well at the street kids school. So this was a protest that they had organized. They wanted to go onto the streets and they were demanding for human, they were demanding human rights. It might have actually been on International Human Rights Day a few years ago. So they were demanding their right to education. And then across in the right-hand top corner, this is their permaculture project. So they've had people like Rosemary Morrow, who is an Australian permaculture expert, go over and teach them a course. And they also do tree planting as well, sort of more guerrilla tree planting. They'll go around Kabul planting trees. And so a lot of these young people who were part of the project as teenagers, they've grown up. And the last picture is a project which one of these grown up Afghan peace volunteers has gone off and set up himself in his home village of Bamiyan. And this is Solar Dish project. So there's a local engineer who sort of retrofits these old satellite dishes into, by sticking tiny mirrors onto them, makes them into sort of solar panel dishes. And you can apparently boil a kettle of water. It takes 40 minutes to boil a kettle of water. And you can also slow cook rice and vegetables on it throughout the day. So that's one of the sort of very, couple of the very cool projects that they get up to. This is a photo I took when we actually went on a little walk up a hilltop. And in the background, you can see all these graveyards. It's on the very edge of Kabul. And it was a bit of a crazy road trip with a bunch of teenagers in a bus with loads of sort of Bollywood music blaring out and very exuberant teenagers. And we climbed up this mountaintop and they had a huge stereo that they lumped to the top of it. So we just had this kind of ghetto blaster blaring out music as we climbed up this spectacularly beautiful mountain. And, you know, they're just full of the joys of life, even though they're from this, you know, very heavy environment whereby there's suffering and violence everywhere. But I thought this was a really optimistic picture of young people passing through the history of their country, which has been rife with turmoil, but they're still optimistic, they're still hopeful, and they're energetic for a better country. And a lot of them are saying they're not going to leave, they're going to stay, they're going to fight for a more prosperous future. So I will just pause there because we've got about 15 minutes left and I thought maybe you might want to sort of ask some questions. The booklet that I put together last year is £3, so I can just send it to you because actually I'm trying to get rid of them now. You know how it is when you publish something and then it goes a bit out of date. So I could send you a load at a discount price. And then we're also doing... you know, if you want to sort of send us a donation as well for some of these projects in Afghanistan, then we actually send it over via very dubious methods using Western Union. But that is the easiest way of doing it. So yeah, I'd like to open the floor for some questions or comments.
Thanks very much, Maya. That's brilliant. Yeah, I forgot to mention at the beginning